happy to have Ed Barbier here on today's episode of Dialogues for the Common Good. Our topic today will be a discussion of his new, absolutely exciting book called Economics for a Fragile Planet, Rethinking Markets, Institutions and Governance. The book came out, I think, in March this year.
Correct.
So, Ed, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Ingmar. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you here again. So after having had you for the Meet Top Environment and Economist series, I think it's a pleasure to talk about your new book. So for those of you who don't know him yet, Ed Barbier is a university distinguished professor in the Department of Economics at Colorado State University and a senior scholar in the School of Global Environmental Stability. His main expertise is environmental and resource economics and international environmental policy. Ed has written a whole bunch of scientific articles and several books, and most of these are really published in top journals. So if there's an expert out there, well, we have him here on our Dialogues for the Common Good today. And the goal today is, well, discuss your new book. The title again is Economics for a Fragile Planet, Rethinking Markets, Institutions and Governance. Ed, can you briefly summarize what's the main message of the book?
Yes, thanks, Ingmar. The main message of Economics for a Fragile Planet is pretty much captured in the title. Scientific evidence tells us that we're facing a number of global environmental crises. And the question is, what does economics have to offer to address these crises? And what I try to argue in this book is that we do have the economic tools, but we need to apply those tools in a way that we have not done before, to think about how we need to revamp our markets, governance, and institutions to address these crises. And I suggest that we have to build our economic approach around five organizing principles. One is ending the underpricing of nature. The second is fostering collective action at the global level, but also regional level. Thirdly, accepting absolute limits. Fourth is to attain sustainability. And finally, to promote inclusivity, because to tackle these crises, we have to make sure that those who are made worse off no longer suffer disproportionately. So, and the four crises that I focus on in this book to illustrate how we have to change our markets, institutions, and governments by both businesses and policies, are the four crises are climate change, deterioration of our ocean and coastal habitats, freshwater scarcity, and then land use change and biodiversity loss. Those are, to me, are the four major crises. The other thing that I try to emphasize in this book is that we have this window of opportunity. I mean, the world's earth and ecosystems are under tremendous strain from the human impacts from our economy. And unless we address those impacts, and unless we embed our economy in nature rather than treating nature as something out there that we either exploit or we pollute for free, unless we change this, we're going to continue to have those impacts accelerate, and we're going to lead us, we're going to end up in a world that is at best uncertain in terms of these environmental risks and potential catastrophes, and at worst, it's going to be very catastrophic for humans. And what we want is a world that's safer, in which humankind can continue to thrive and prosper economically. So it's a very ambitious book, but I think it's also very important at this time, because we really have the next 10 or 20 years to turn things around, given the trends that we've seen in the last 50 years of more and more stress on the Earth's ecosystems and indeed the Earth system itself.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that's a very good summary. Who should read your book?
The book is aimed not just at my fellow economists, but it's really aimed for a broader audience. all who really care about the environment and want to understand the role of economics in reducing all these risks that I just talked about. I also am very pleased that there's been a positive response from the business community, because a lot of what I say in the book is that it's important that we get our markets and our policies right, but the real important agents for change are business. Unless business sees that there is a vested interest in controlling these and mitigating these environmental risks, it's not going to happen. We can't rely on governments doing it alone. So the business community, the financial community is also one of the audiences. And then finally, of course, policymakers, those that are struggling with decision making, having to face these long term crises and being asked to increasingly by the people in their countries and regions. Policymakers also are the aim of this book.
So let's say I'm someone who has read a bit on climate issues, on policy. I'm a politician, maybe a ministry of the environment. What would be new for me?
I think there's two things. The first is the stress I put on the first principle of ending the underpricing of nature and changing the mindset that we have in our economies. So what I mean by that is that the way our economy works today is that we treat nature as if it has zero value in our economy, because most of what nature does for us, whether it's mitigating climate or whether it's coastal wetlands that are protecting us against storms, and I'm using mainly climate examples here since your question, or the economic consequences of fresh water scarcity and drought because of climate change, all these things that we're seeing are because we have treated what nature has done for us to protect us and to support our economic activity as a free lunch, as a free good. We don't value nature services in our economy because most of them don't appear in our markets. It's been excluded. It's something that happens out there. What we do take from nature are materials and energy in various forms, whether it's fossil fuels or whether it's trees and biomass. And we do price those goods and services. But the vast majority of what nature does that supports and protects our economic activity is we give it zero credence in our policies, our markets, and our decisions. So that's the first thing, is to understand the scope at which nature provides so many valuable services and goods to us that we just treat as free. But to go a step further, unfortunately, we also actually subsidize, or we pay a lot of economic activities to actually destroy the environment. So we underprice fossil fuels because we don't take into account the damages they do to climate. We don't take account the local damages they do for in terms of pollutions, harm to people's livelihoods, to their health, and possibly a cause of death and congestion and all these things. All these extra costs of fossil fuels are not included in our pricing or our decisions to use fossil fuels. And then on top of that, we often subsidize in many countries the exploration production of more fossil fuels, or we provide credit, favorable credit as well, or we write off taxes for new investments in fossil fuels. All these things make us more dependent on fossil fuels rather than make a transition to cleaner and less damaging energy sources. And so that's how our decisions get distorted against nature and for its exploitation. And you can pick a number of other examples, whether it's in the fishery sector, whether it's in the forestry sector, whether it's in agricultural sector. We see that over and over again. So the scale of the underpricing of nature is huge, both because we do not value the valuable goods and services that are vastly disappearing in nature, and because we actually gives nature effectively a negative price by subsidizing and promoting activities that harm nature more than they should. The third part of all this is that we actually underfund the protection of nature. We underfund investments that could either conserve what's left of nature or invest in restoring it where nature has been degraded or lost in the past. And we have to find creative ways of funding nature. And in my book, I explain this. There's a gap between how much we protect nature and what we do. So there's two examples illustrate the point. The OECD has estimated that 50 countries spend about $112 billion on environmentally harmful agricultural subsidies. That's about the same amount that the world as a whole, governments, donor agencies, business, NGOs, philanthropists, about $100 billion is what we spend every year in protecting nature. So just one sector in our economy, through just subsidies for one sector, agriculture, that are environmentally harmful, just nets out what we spend every year in protecting nature. So the question is, obviously, removing those environmentally harmful subsidies from agriculture would be one way of reallocating money to more nature protection. We could double nature protection if we did that. More importantly, we have to find other creative ways to increase all of our spending on protecting and restoring nature. And then we have to find the incentives for businesses and governments to make those investments and to recycle revenues from let's say, removing environmentally harmful subsidies or taxing environmental harm, such as pollution, excessive pollution, or excess resource depletion, recycle some of those monies to help pay for what we need to do to protect and restore. And so there's many examples of that. I focus on business because business actually, through their supply chains, are very vulnerable to the type of losses to nature that we're starting to see today, particularly biodiversity loss. Businesses are realizing that these natural services that are being lost are real risks to their business and their bottom line. And once they start to realize that and understand that, then they may start having an incentive to changing their business operations, their investments. And increasingly, the financial institutions that are investing in businesses are starting to ask these questions. What have you done lately as a business to deal with water scarcity, which is becoming more and more a problem? What are you doing today and in your businesses in the near future to deal with climate risks? What are you doing today to deal with the vulnerability of your supply chain to biodiversity loss? These are questions that investors are increasingly asking businesses, and businesses are increasingly having to respond and do something about it.
What I also liked was, and found important, was how you tied everything in with issues of fairness and poverty reduction. Could you say a word about that, maybe?
Yes. I have been observing for many years, and I write about in this book, and others have observed, is increasingly the loss of natural services is felt disproportionately on the poor. One of the interesting things that has come out recently is that when the International Monetary Fund estimated global underpricing of fossil fuels, they found that the biggest cost in developing countries of underpricing fossil fuels was not climate change, but the costs of mortality and sickness caused by pollution. And that disproportionately impacts the poor crowded into cities because they can't afford air conditioning. They can't afford living in houses that are in nice neighborhoods with trees and so forth. And we're seeing that in rich countries too. The people who are suffering the most from heat waves, from drought, from wildfires, they tend to be in the most vulnerable communities and the poorest communities exposed to these risks. Same thing with coastal risks from storm. It's in New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina in 2005. The people who were forced to leave their homes the most, and the majority of people who died, and the people who lost everything they had, were the poorest people living in the exposed areas of New Orleans. And we're seeing that time and time again, whether it's natural disasters, ongoing pollution problems, resource exploitation, and so forth. We're seeing it in land use change, where most of the land use change is not caused by small holders and poor people chopping down trees. It's caused by large business concerns, basically doing large scale conversion of tropical forests for commercial activities. And the people who lose out are local communities, often indigenous communities that tend to be poor. So impact of nature is actually that we've been seeing in recent decades has actually been more borne by the poor and worsened the problem of wealth and income inequality in the world that we're also seeing.
And by raising taxes on pollution, for example, you suggest that it is actually possible to improve the living conditions for those worst off and for those that are affected by climate change and environmental hazards.
Yes, well, this is where the design comes. Often in environmental economics, we stop at the control of the environmental problem. So, for example, your example, if we impose a tax on carbon for pollution, we think the story is ended because we've imposed the tax and it's over. But the revenue that's earned, how we spend that revenue, can be critical to addressing the problem of who gains and who loses, and to addressing some of the distributional consequences. So increasingly, we're looking at, well, how do we spend the carbon revenues that we've earned? I know that Switzerland, as well as Canada more recently, have been playing around with a dividend rebate of carbon taxes. So the dividend, what that means is that the money that's raised through carbon tax goes back to households as a dividend. And that, of course, disproportionately benefits the poorer households, because the dividend check is a much important part, a bigger part of their income than, let's say, a richer household. Tropical countries, there's been creative uses of carbon taxes. The example that I cite is the tropical carbon taxes in Costa Rica and Colombia. Since 1997, and more recently from 2016, both Costa Rica and Colombia have used carbon taxes, a small carbon tax, mostly on imported fossil fuels, selective imported fossil fuels, to not only reduce the use of those fuels, but also the money is then, some of it is recycled into nature-based solutions and conservation in forests and other ecosystems. And in Costa Rica's case, Costa Rica has been running this policy since 1997, they deliberately target ecosystems and communities that are the poorest in the country, in rural areas. So 40% of the spending of the revenues on ecosystem conservation is going to some of the poorest rural communities in Costa Rica. So these are ways in which we can think, how can we use the policy to control the environmental destruction? How do we design it so it reduces activities that benefit mainly the wealthy? And third, how do we use the revenues in a wise way that will reduce some of the distributional consequences or improve the lot of the poorest that would otherwise not receive those benefits?
You already stated this, your book emphasizes five principles which are needed in order to manage the environmental problems. So it's ending underpricing of nature, collective action, or fostering collective action, accepting the limits, attaining sustainability, and promoting
inclusivity.
Inclusivity, yes, sorry. My thought was, where do you feel are currently the biggest gaps in what, if I'm a politician, which of these five principles should I put most emphasis on? If I'm a researcher, where should I start my research program?
That's a very interesting question. For politicians, I think the one I would start with would be ending the underpricing for the reasons I gave. But if speaking to my fellow economists, what I have stressed in my other writings and also in this one is that the hardest one for economists to accept is accepting absolute limits. Because of the nature in which we think about the world in economics is always a relative trade-off and a relative scarcity. One good becomes scarce, its price rises relative to another. But we've already made this leap in the case of certain environmental problems. So if we take climate change, we've already accepted an absolute limit. We need to find policies to keep us under 1.5, and if we have to, 2 degree warming. We know as economists that the scientists are correct to say that if we exceed this limit, we are in an uncertain world where we could have lots of catastrophes, so that the type of things we're seeing already, such as the extreme heat wave and wildfires in Europe, which have been unprecedented, the droughts and the water scarcity in the Western United States, which have been unprecedented, one third to one half of Pakistan underwater, that's unprecedented. These sort of unprecedented events, if we don't control, keep to that limit, are going to be the norm from year in and year out. And we know that as economists, and which is why many economists have agreed that we need to find policies, and that many economists are working on that to accept those policies. To me, that's a very important change of thought in economics that has not happened since the beginning of our discipline. Back in the old days when we argued, when the classical economists argued about Malthusian versus Ricardian scarcity. We now must recognize, and that requires both absolute limits and collective action, accepting absolute limits. We may have to do the same thing with the other problems I talked about, freshwater scarcity, deteriorating ocean habitats and coasts, and also loss of biodiversity and land use change. Taking oceans and coasts, what concerns everybody in the world about oceans and coasts is the incredibly exponential rise of plastics, microplastic pollution in our oceans. You go back to the 1970s, there was hardly any microplastics in our ocean. Now they're everywhere. We find them in all our seawater, our oceans, even in the deepest parts of the ocean. And this concerns everybody because of the damage it's doing to the one ecosystem that we know the least about, which is our ocean systems. We don't know how it works and how important. Well, we know something about how it works, but not completely. And there's there are parts of the ocean that have not been explored by humankind yet. That's just a good example of something that we may have to say, all right, we got to do something about microplastics or the extent of pollution. We may have to accept absolute limits and then work within those to design the right policies, incentives, institutions, and governments to respect that limits. And so that's what I mean. Collective action, like I said, is very big. And I think it's a very big issue at this time when we're seeing an era where the rise of anti-democratic forces and democratic forces are clashing. We're having the revival very nationalist, self-interested, and quite frankly, anti-democratic, autocratic forces in all countries. Some countries are completely that way. Others that are democratic have large anti-democratic tendencies that are increasing. And in general, what we see is that autocratic rule and autocratic forces tend to work against collective action globally. And the countries that are more fostering global goals and global collective actions and working together tend to be more democratic. And they're tending to say, we need to do something about global climate change and some of these other global issues. And I think that, that's becoming a an important part of what we have to do.
Mm. So which of the five principles do you believe are most attainable in the near future, and by what means?
Wow, that's a difficult one to predict. I would turn my answer is actually slightly different. I think we don't have much choice but to attain all these five principles in very short period of time. I think we have this window of opportunity in the next 10 to 20 years to do something about these major global environmental risks, and it will require all five principles. But so I don't think we have the luxury of saying, okay, we can do one but not the other and all that. I think we need to do it, but I do think we have to make a start on the two most urgent ones, which is ending the underpricing of nature and collective action. I think that there needs to be a greater consensus among businesses, among governments, among governments with businesses, that we have to embed our economy in nature. And to do that, we have to end the underpricing of nature in many of our policies and approaches. And then and that requires reforms of our markets, governments, and institutions. To do that, we also need collective action. And I think that's very important. Realizing that we are facing these risks and that we have to accept absolute limits is part of the transition of the way we look at economy and nature. And until we stop treating nature as if it's something that is unlimited to exploit or unlimited to pollute, we're going to be in trouble with rational, in our minds as humans, thinking about this as a collective problem that we have to solve that turns our economy into something that is part of nature, not something outside, or nature's outside of our economy. It's a tall order, but I think it's incredibly important. I have been encouraged by a number of things in recent years, as well as discouraged by a few. But I think that collective action is important. And I think how it will happen is that an increasing number of powerful governments who realize that it's to the benefit of all, including themselves individually as countries, realize that they have to work together. Maybe not everybody in the world will join initially, but at least if the most powerful groups of countries that share democratic aims, that share a collective belief in the future of the world, and believe that that environmental crises are here to stay, and we have to work together to address them. I think that is an incredibly important, powerful motivation to collectively work together as like-minded governments to address this. Same with businesses. I think if enough major corporations and key industries work together to be biosphere stewards as opposed to biosphere exploiters, then we will have a more positive outcome. And I think that's starting to happen in certain industries, and it's starting to happen with pressure in certain financial quarters. And the signs are encouraging. The question I'm concerned about is, do we have enough time? Now, people are putting their toes in the water, but they're not jumping in. And there's not enough people jumping in. Enough.
Cold water sometimes.
Sorry?
It's sometimes cold water. So.
It absolutely is. We have set up our economy for thousands of years to be like this. You can trace back, and I've done that in a previous book looking at the history of natural resources exploitation throughout humankind. And since the agricultural revolution or the agricultural transition from hunter-gatherers 12,000 years ago, we have constantly been exploiting nature as if it's unlimited, and that there's enough space out there to dump all our waste. And that's how we have gone, proceeded through the growth of empires and big cities, to the beginning of trade, through the Industrial Revolution, to the fossil fuel era, to the present day, is treating nature as something that we can just, that's bigger than us, that we can just treat as any way we want. That's how our economic system's been developed, and that's the driving principle of our economic system. And changing that or modifying that is not an easy task, but we've reached a crisis point, and we have got to start addressing this, which has never been attempted in human history. So it's a tall order, but it's one I don't see any other choice, but it's a necessary solution to the problems.
One thing that you show is that there are significant subsidies to the dirty industry. You relate this to the underpricing of nature. And I'd say that you vigorously support that these subsidies should be scrapped. One question that occurred to me is in what time frame, if we just immediately scrap all these subsidies, there will be important problems with, I guess, supply chains and so on. Do you have any notion of how politicians should do this in an efficient way?
Well, I actually in the book argue for phasing out subsidies, and this has to, although I do believe that many subsidies are environmentally harmful, and I try very hard to identify the ones that are environmentally harmful. Those should be ended. There's no question. But often the problem is that, of course, a whole industry has built up or depended on it, and there may be workers in the industry and communities that are dependent on the increased production that comes from these subsidies. So you do need to think carefully about how you phase out the subsidies. And in some cases, it may not be a full phase out or a complete ending, but it could be a simple swap. And I give an example with fossil fuel subsidies in developing countries. On the one hand, we know that most of the fossil fuel subsidies in developing countries are often consumption subsidies for increasing the consumption of fossil fuels, whether it's gasoline for cars or it's production of electricity that's based on fossil fuels and so forth. We also know that most of these subsidies benefit largely wealthier households in urban areas of developing countries. We also know, a third thing we know, is that most of the poor people in developing countries are in rural areas. The vast majority can be as high as 85% of the extreme poverty, maybe more, maybe less, are in rural areas. But it is a majority. And often the poverty in the rural areas is combined with things like lack of access to any energy resource, any energy services, no electricity, no reliable sources of anything except for biomass and charcoal and so forth. So one of the things that one might consider, and others have studied, and I've used their findings, is that why not reduce fossil fuel subsidies in developing countries that benefit the rich in urban areas by about 10 or 20% or maybe even 30%. And the money, which actually turns out to be quite substantial, could be in the billions of dollars, could be used for subsidies to promote renewable energy, particularly in rural areas. So for example, there are pilot programs in India and Bangladesh that are called solar safety nets, which are essentially programs that bring solar energy and solar panels off grid, small scale diesel and generators and biogas use to rural communities that are well beyond the infrastructure of conventional electricity, utility and power plant supply. And these solar safety nets could be funded and expanded if you swap some of the fossil fuel subsidies out from promoting renewable energy, particularly in last mile parts of the world, remote areas of the world where you have poor people. What some of the studies have shown is that by just removing fossil fuel subsidies by 10 to 30%, you would have a tremendous impact on reducing that country's, the average country's greenhouse gas emissions. It's anywhere from 6 to 10% if you remove that fossil. And then if you put that money towards promoting renewable energy in general, but particularly energy in remote areas targeted at the poor, you could also have achieved some of your development objectives, and particularly reducing poverty. So that's the type of thing we have to think about creatively in this new world we're facing.
Well, in this new world that we're facing, you also suggested that businesses should get a much more important seat at the table. They should be involved in the discussions. If you talk to many environmentalists, one issue that you will hear a lot will be the notion of greenwashing, and that most businesses are simply not interested in sincerely doing the effort that is needed. Is it not too early, or maybe a bit, let me be rough, naive, to suggest that businesses should be sitting at the table?
I think that that it's not too early. I think I'm worried it's too late that we don't get businesses at the table. Because as I said before, I don't see societal change, market change, leading to reduction in these environmental risks unless business is at the table, unless business has sees that it's in their incentive to do it. But I agree with you, and I agree with many critics. We're at this point now where myself included, we're tired of greenwash from business and hogwash from politicians. We're tired of business and politicians saying, oh, we care about the environment, we care about climate change, it's a bad thing, or we know our supply chain is at risk from biodiversity. But then both politicians and businesses do very little to enact anything. To use a sports analogy from the United States, they're doing what we call running out the clock. They're basically hoping that if they can carry on with business as usual and just talk the talk of greenwash and hogwash from politicians and not actually do anything, and nobody will either notice or it'll be someone else's problem in a few years' time, that as they step down as a CEO or their term as in office ends. And that's what we've been doing as society. And I think that in many countries where people have votes and where people have dollars in their pockets, and they have shares in their bank, they can make a huge impact on these entities, how they spend their dollars, how they vote, and how they demand from as shareholders from accountability is increasingly becoming a very powerful tool. So I hope that my book also reaches people who, ordinary citizens who have dollars, shares, and votes, who realize they can do something. What is encouraging to me is that we have seen a lot of movement at more local and regional levels throughout many countries, where people are demanding from their local politicians, their local businesses, and change. And that's starting to resonate up the political and business supply chain to the corporate headquarters. And it's starting to make a difference. I'll give you a couple examples. I live, my university is in Fort Collins, Colorado. Fort Collins has put a ban on plastics. And so you cannot get plastics at any grocery or retail place anymore, plastic bags for the produce you buy or the goods that you buy. It's got to be paper or some alternative. The state of California has just put in a regulation that by 2035, no new vehicles bought in California will be gasoline fueled. And on top of that, if you try to sell, if you're a car maker and you try to sell a gasoline-powered vehicle, you're going to be slapped with a $20,000 fine. Now, I'm not a big fan of using regulations and bans like that. But on the other hand, California has a carbon tax. It has other things going on. This is, I think, an important incentive step, having both the ban plus a penalty on top to enforce it. And it's going to start major car makers to think again about the market for California. And that's important because we would not have the hybrid vehicle hadn't been California's laws that came in the 80s and 90s. The hybrid came in faster than was expected because of what California did with its zero emission vehicle and zero pollution standards. It can be a powerful impact. What happens at your local level and your state level, or in the case of the United States. Those are just two examples. I'm interested to see certain experiments at federal levels. Canada, during the pandemic, brought in a $50 per ton tax on carbon, and they're also experimenting with putting some of that back as a dividend to their household, some of the revenues. I'm interested to see how that works. And they're building on the model that British Columbia started and about 10 or 15 years ago. So it's already we're seeing these more local and regional policies having an influence at larger levels. And even in the United States, where we're seeing deadlock at the national level with regard to policies, we're seeing some movement with new incentives coming in to encourage people to buy electric vehicles and solar power installations for their houses and businesses. So things are happening. Hmm. The question is, are they enough and are they soon enough? That's the big question.
I'd have one more question. In the book, you emphasize a lot of the importance of collective action. Now, again, many researchers would say we have had many attempts at making collective action work for climate change. It just didn't work out in the way that we had hoped it would. Why should this be any different for land use change and biodiversity and oceans?
Well, I actually think that collective action has been somewhat successful with climate change. The Paris Agreement in 2015 is the first time we have really a commitment by a number, almost all the countries in the world, to a global goal. Now, whether they live up to their pledges or not, I don't know. I can't see that all countries doing it. But what's very interesting is that many of the major sources, many of the countries that are the major sources of greenhouse gas emissions are trying their best to keep up to that pledge that they made. And so there's encouragement there. It's never a clean process of getting to a collective outcome. But I think that increasingly, there is collective action going on. Much of what I have focused on has said that the leadership globally for collective action on the government side has to come from the group of 20, which is the 20 largest economies and most populous economies in the world. They account for almost all of our greenhouse gases. They account for almost all of our economy globally. And they account for almost all the population. And what the G20 does and what countries do in the G20 matter a lot. What's very interesting to me is that I'm not as optimistic that G20 as a group will take the initiative. I am more optimistic that the democratic members, the traditionally democratic members of the G20, more like the G7 plus, there's about 10 to 15 countries that are either largely free and democratic, or at least somewhat free. That group could still work collectively, even though the Russias, Chinas, and possibly Turkeys and others that are less democratic in the G20 may not join them. It's time for whoever wants to work collectively to get together and move collectively towards the actions we need for addressing these environmental risks. And yes, it is going to be a challenge for some of the other environmental risks, such as water scarcity and controlling damage to biodiversity and so forth. I also call from my book that businesses work collectively within it. And one of the things I emphasize is that if you look at the major industries of the world, the global industries that have an impact on the environment, there's about 20 to 25 that I document in the book. Most of them are dominated by a handful of firms. And those firms could do something to make their entire industry greener. And if they do that, others will follow suit. Already we're seeing movement in some areas. The insurance industry is starting to take environmental risks carefully because that translates into direct costs that they have to insure. The seafood industry is a large number of the major seafood companies have worked together with scientists to try and figure out how do we manage seafood stocks globally in the world. That they control or either directly or indirectly as industry. We're starting to see certain industries like the shipping industry recognizing that they're a big contributor to greenhouse gas emissions, and they have put in some additional rules for controlling emissions from their transportation services on the oceans. So there is some positive signs. And equally from the investment side, we're seeing something, a very powerful entity like the U.S. Security and Exchange Commission's consider bringing in, they've put together a proposal for mandatory climate risk reporting by firms, mainly in the United States, but others that have operations in the United States as well. So there is movement that's happening. It's not, I think, enough, and it's not happening quick enough, but I'm starting to see it, and I hope we continue.
Yeah, that sounds like a positive response. Yeah.
But this book is about scary stuff. There's no question. I'm talking about major global environmental risks, and I do talk about, you know, the beginning part I do a very quick overview of what's gone wrong and the scale of the problem. But I immediately try and get into what can we do about it. This is a book about what can we do and how quickly can we do it and how can we do it in a relatively cost-effective way, in a fairer way. That's what this book is about. And it's not good enough anymore for us to say the sky is falling and not say how we do something about it. And I believe strongly that economics is the most important discipline. And our economy is central to understanding what's gone wrong and also correcting the problem. We can do this. The task is a momentous and it's urgent, but there is light at the end of the tunnel. That's what the book's about.
So to our listeners, viewers, let me just give a very brief thought on the book from what I really liked about it. So I really liked that it emphasized much more than usual the problem of underpricing nature and the fact that nature is underfunded, but it doesn't just stop there, but it really goes deeply also in the various solutions. And if you're a policymaker, I think you'll find many solutions in that book and many policy approaches that could be used in order to solve that problem. So I really think Ed has done a really great job collecting all that. It's not just a book which tells you where the problems are, but it's also a book that gives you the solutions, and it gives many, many examples that will also help you to see that these solutions are already being implemented. What I feel is also very important, and there you have done a great job, is that you give a balanced and honest account of what is going on and what can be done. So it's not a one-sided plea. We must save the environment, given any price, and there is only one way to do this. And if we do this, then we'll have plenty of green jobs that will be created and so on. No, it's not that. It's really evidence-based. It's theory-based, and it shows that you have thought about this topic and that you have that you have a notion, that you have a real understanding of what works, what is likely to work, and what doesn't work. Well, and I think it also covers really the most important problems that we currently face. Climate change, ecosystems, land use change, biodiversity, freshwater, and oceans. And it gives plenty of examples for any politician, for any reader who is interested, for any researcher, to see that, yeah, there are solutions. There are solutions that are already being implemented. More can be done through, for example, collective actions, through public policy, with the businesses. And that gives a very holistic picture that I think very few other books have done so far. And I just want to finish with something that I read by Sir Partha Dasgupta about the book. He said, this is the most thorough and expansive introduction to the conception that sees the human economy as embedded in nature. Beautifully written and technically adroit, it displays the author's wide social sympathies. University courses in environment and resource economics can find no superior text today to include on the list. So if that isn't a statement that should make you read the book, then I don't know what else to say. Ed, I thank you very much for having given the chance to have a nice discussion about your book. And I hope this motivates lots of readers to go out and buy it, support the good cause, and potentially find some solutions.
Thanks, Ingmar. I really appreciate you having me, and always talking with you is just a great pleasure. Our dialogues are always fantastic.
Ed, I wish you all the best, and I'm sure we'll meet again very soon.
See you, Ingmar. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.